The Spinoff Podcast Network.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spinoff. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spinoff member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
You're listening to Business is Boring, a podcast that reckons it's anything but. Business is Boring is brought to you by Spark Lab, offering inspiration and practical advice to help businesses find their edge. To hear more about Spark Lab, including details about the latest events, workshops, and business tools, visit sparklab.co.nz. And now, here's your host, Simon Pound.
Kia ora koutou katoa, welcome to Business is Boring. Women make up more than half the population, but have been woefully neglected in the way we have studied, funded, and focused medical research and technology. One local company is part of the wave working to address this imbalance. Junofem is a medtech company who make a device to help measure and improve pelvic floor health and performance. It is an issue that can affect up to 1 in 3 women worldwide, and their FemFit device is part of their work to remove the stigma around urinary incontinence. It's a very cool company addressing a really big problem spun out of the Auckland Bioengineering Institute. Joining us is the co-founder and CEO, Dr. Jenny Kruger, to talk the journey, the problem, and working to address the systemic imbalance toward women in health. Tanakwe, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
Hey, first up, let's talk about this problem. As with so many things to do with the experience of women in the world, right, it's something that is not talked about as much as it should be. So what is the situation with urinary incontinence and how many people does it affect?
Yeah, you're quite right. It is something that we don't speak about enough. It affects many more than you would imagine. As you mentioned in your intro, 1 in 3, so that's 30% of all women will struggle with urinary incontinence at some stage in their lives. And this is a frightening statistic, actually, particularly as we know that we can do something about it. It's not normal, but it's common. We're in the business of trying to help women to realize that they can actually do something about the problem. And it's not all down to just surgery or putting up with it.
And so how does that manifest? Because I imagine with that number of people affected, that many women affected, a lot of people wouldn't know that it was a problem they could address or do something about, right? And just kind of think that's just the way things are.
Yeah, that's the problem. Many people do think that that's just what we have to put up with. It's a natural part of aging, or it's what happens after you've had a baby. And we just have to disprove those myths that it's not. There is definitely something you can do about it. And it typically manifests as involuntary leakage of urine. The most common type is when you leak when you laugh or cough or jump, sneeze. Sometimes just intense physical activity causes women to leak. It doesn't discriminate for age. It doesn't discriminate for ethnicity. It's a worldwide problem amongst most of the population. We are most vulnerable post-childbirth and as we age, and particularly towards the menopause. But it can happen at any point in our lives. So, yeah, it's an issue. We need to talk about it. We need to get it out there. So.
And many people may have heard people, you know, kind of making light of it or something like, oh, won't be jumping on the trampoline, you know. But like, how should people be thinking about this and what can be done?
So I think women should, first of all, be aware that, as I said, it is common but not normal. Any involuntary leakage of urine is not normal. You will likely be aware of your pelvic floor muscles for the first time, perhaps when you are pregnant. You may have classes from antenatal classes, or be aware when your tummy is growing bigger and bigger, that you start to have a bit of leakage. Doing pelvic floor muscle training during pregnancy, we know, is very effective, particularly for after the baby is born. But even after the baby's born, you might find that many women will experience those symptoms that I've described, particularly when they do pick up their baby, they want to go for a walk around the block, and every time they do that, they leak. So your first port of call then is containment products, so pads or something like that, speaking to their friends or their mums or their aunties. And sometimes, unfortunately, it is normalized, and so people don't feel the need that they should do something. But if you're still leaking even 12 weeks after having that baby, you should be doing something about it. And typically for those kind of incontinence symptoms I've described, strengthening those pelvic floor muscles which support the bladder will definitely help relieve those symptoms. So it's not something you have to put up with. It is a muscle. It's a muscle like any other muscle in the body. You go to the gym, you train, you know, you make yourself strong and functional, and it's the same with the pelvic floor muscles. So we encourage women to do that. Unfortunately, it isn't something that is intuitive. So when you are given instructions on how to do pelvic floor exercises, it's usually in the form of a verbal instruction or a pamphlet, if you can get hold of those pamphlets. And it's descriptions like squeeze and lift and hold. And it's squeeze and lift and hold what? Mm. You know, what? So I think giving women clarity and effective means to help them with their pelvic floor muscle training is really worthwhile, and that's kind of our aim.
Yeah, and those exercises that, you know, lots of people would have heard of them as being Kegels,
yeah,
right?
That's
is
right.
that how you say it?
Kegels? Yeah, Kegels, right.
Yeah, and that's kind of like a famous kind of concept in the world. But like you say, you know, what are you squeezing, lifting and holding? How do you know if you're doing it right?
It's well, not it's like exactly,
you can
yeah.
look at your form doing a bicep curl or something,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, how did you become aware of that problem that people weren't able to monitor or understand really how those Kegels or pelvic floor exercises were working? How did you become aware of that problem and set out to solve that?
My background many, many years ago is clinical. So midwifery, actually. So I became very, and have always been very passionate about women's health, particularly maternal women's health. I was a midwife for a lot of part of my career. And I know that actually the birth process in itself leads us at risk for these complications that happen afterwards. Your pelvic floor muscles, because of their anatomical locations, are involved in the birth process. Sometimes they don't spring back to normal, and you need to exercise them, as I've explained, after the baby's born. But because of where they are, we don't know. I was lucky in that after I decided to go back to academia, I did a master's degree in childbirth, and then a PhD looking at sports and exercise in elite athletes and their pelvic floor and childbirth. And then I got a postdoc, which is after a fellowship, at the Auckland Bioengineering Institute. And that was fortuitous in that the skill set at the institute means I had access to engineers that could build stuff, basically. And so probably 10 or 12 years ago now, I started, when I got the first fellowship, a research group within the institute that comprised a number of engineers, clinicians. And we knew that there was an unmet clinical need. And that unmet clinical need was, how do we accurately measure things? And that's what the engineers at the institute are good at. They create instrumentation to measure physiological processes, typically. And I've been incredibly lucky to have been associated with very smart engineers who have managed to, together with all our clinicians, over the past, honestly, a decade, create something which we now are really confident in that can measure accurately changes in pressure, which will give women very good biofeedback as to what's happening at the level of the pelvic floor. Because we knew that women didn't know, couldn't see, and all the devices that were currently out there were not as good as we were hoping. They couldn't accurately measure what we really wanted to measure. So it's been a process. It's been a long process, but we've kind of got there at the end. So,
how does the solution work? Like, what does the product like look like? How do women use it? How do people use it?
So the device itself is very slim. It's very flexible. It's made of a medical grade silicon, and it consists of 8 tiny little pressure sensors. It's an intravaginal device, so you pop it in, much like you would a tampon. It sits along the length of the vagina, and then when you are able to do a contraction, it connects to an app on your phone, and each of those little sensors is represented by a bar. And so the instructions to the users are to keep the purple bars higher than the black bar. So typically, as I said, you get verbal instruction to squeeze and lift and hold. But what a lot of women do is they squeeze their tummy muscles, they squeeze the butt together, they clench their legs. And it's difficult. I mean, if I asked you to squeeze and lift your pelvic floor now, what would you do?
Yeah, I wouldn't know if I was doing it right or wrong.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So we're on the way for men, but not quite yet. Mm. But for women, it's a very simple instruction in that they can then see if they are doing those exercises effectively. So the key issues are effective pelvic floor muscle exercises, and the exercises have to be of an intensity that actually will change that muscle. So when you go to the gym and you do bicep curls or whatever, you need to do it at a certain intensity and so many repetitions with a certain weight to make a difference. And it's the same. It's a muscle. So you need to actually exercise it sufficiently in order to make that change. So, yeah.
What kind of impact does that have? Because, I mean, like any device, right, like it can tell you you're doing it right, but you still need to do the work, right?
Yeah,
you still
absolutely
need to do sufficient exercise to strengthen the muscles. Like, how long does it take, and what are typical, are there typical effects? I imagine it's a very personal and different thing with different people.
Yeah. So what we have done is, because I've come from academia, the program that the app delivers is a program that's been tested in something called a randomized controlled trial. We know it's effective. It takes 12 weeks, so 3 months, and it's progressive in nature. The types of exercises you do are not just a squeeze and hold. You do 4 different types of exercise, and you also change from a lying position, sitting, standing, so it becomes functional. So most women leak when they're standing, so you need to be able to exercise that muscle in the position that you're feeling most vulnerable or you're most compromised or getting those symptoms. And the changes you'll see is you'll stop leaking. So that's really the results that we are seeing. With your pelvic floor muscles, they support your bladder. They support the organs of the pelvis. So in women, that's not just your bladder, that's your uterus, it's your back passage. And sometimes those things too are compromised when your pelvic floor is not functioning well. And so you need to strengthen your pelvic floor muscles in order to maintain those organs in the correct position as well. So pelvic floor muscle exercises can also help with symptoms such as something called pelvic organ prolapse. It's when those organs tend to fall down. Common, again, not as common as incontinence, but common enough. And simple, what we call conservative management. So using those muscles, training those muscles to function better will help with those symptoms as well.
And with something like this that, you know, as we said, can affect up to 1 to 3 women, but if it's concentrated in women over 40, people over 40, you know, it strikes me as being something quite similar to menopause, where
yeah, absolutely,
it affects so many people,
yeah,
you know, within that age group, right, and has been pretty much culturally absent, right?
Absent.
Just not there in the culture, except as like a punchline or something, you know, very stereotypical, and certainly not kind of, you know, raised up and made normal and helping more people understand what people are experiencing. So this must, that 1 in 3 woman must concentrate very heavily in a similar area, right? Like, how have you found going out and building support and talking about it and developing and getting this problem addressed?
again, I think I've been quite lucky having come from academics is I've got a very large network, a large network of people who've worked in the area for a long time. The challenge now is to get it out to the general public. So having conversations around menopause, having conversations around post-baby, actually having conversations around high-impact sport is really important to get the word out that this is not a condition that's normal. I'm going to say it again, it's not normal. and it's about raising the awareness that you can do something about it. So yes, networking for me in the beginning is how we started, but now we're much more into an area where we're using more sort of accepted mechanisms such as marketing and advertising and pushing products to other jurisdictions such as the UK, Australia. We've got a good groundswell in New Zealand, but pushing out to these other global areas where there's a much bigger market will again help the business as well as making it more accessible for women internationally.
How did you go about going from recognizing this problem at the Institute to building a product and turning it into a business with backers and all the rest of it? How does that process go?
It's tricky. So as I said, building the product took 10 years of research. So initially it was a concept. It has been part of students and all of the researchers' programs to get it right for a long time. We have been supported by government grants, luckily, and we made the decision probably back in 2019 to actually make it into a company to take it to the wider public. It wasn't a decision that was taken lightly. It was a decision that we really wanted to grow the medical device industry within New Zealand, again, backed by a government grant. And we made a decision at that point, too, that we would be a medical device company, which meant we had strict regulatory standards to conform to, which made our process a little bit longer than we would have. But again, it's about getting credibility. It's about working with healthcare professionals and accessing those that treat women to know that this is a real valid solution for their patients as well as for women, generally speaking, in the general population. So it wasn't an easy process, but we're very happy the place that we're at now.
There's that famous expression that hardware is hard. And if you then add on top of that medical regulations and what it takes to be able to make a device that's used internally as well, right? Like those are very, very high bars to cross.
They are high bars to cross. And when you do embark on a journey where you've got a piece of hardware and it's a medical device piece of hardware and software, we sometimes say we are a hardware-enabled software company because the software also has to go through the regulatory approval process. But it isn't easy. It takes a lot of time and a lot of resource to go through, make your facility compliant with all the standards for the manufacturing part of things, and also then to apply and go through all the documentation to get your quality management system up and running and to jump through the hoops, and there are many hoops. It's taken us about 2 years to get to the point where we've just submitted for our FDA approval.
Wow. And at the same time, making it feel like it's a easy, simple, you don't have to think about it product.
Yes, exactly.
And we'll be back in a moment to talk about growing the business and the world of women's health tech. Hey, Business is Boring listener. Have you ever wanted to come along to a live Business is Boring record? Because we have one happening Tuesday, January the 30th from 3 p.m. at the Spark NZ building, Victoria Street West in Auckland City. We're going to be talking to the Spark Sustainability Director, Leela Gantman, and the CEO of the Sustainable Business Network, Rachel Brown, and discussing how you can set the right sustainability strategy for your business. If you'd like to head along, that's 3 p.m. Tuesday, January 30th, we'd love to have you. Drop us a line to RSVP or to find out more on commercial@thespinoff.co.nz. Spark is proud to partner with the Sustainable Business Network and the Climate Action Toolbox. The free Climate Action Toolbox can provide you with simple step-by-step guides to measure and reduce your emissions. Help lead the way to a low-carbon future for New Zealand. Visit sparklab.co.nz/sustainability to find out more.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has the lowdown on everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. Join some of the superstars of the investment and business world as they share advice from their time in the US so you can make your mahi count in this massive market. The Investment Fix podcast, brought to you by Invest New Zealand. Tune in today.
Hoki mai anō, welcome back to Business is Boring, where we're with Dr. Jenny Kruger of JunoFem. So how was it to raise, when you made that decision in 2019 to go out as a company from the Institute, how did you find it raising? As the, you know, it's so well known how underfunded and how many blind spots there are in the world of traditional funding for things that are focused on, you know, the biggest possible market there is, women.
Yes, it wasn't easy. It isn't easy. And as you know, a lot of women health tech, femtech is terribly underfunded. And there are a lot of statistics around it. You alluded to 4% of all companies, women's health tech, have been funded. And I should imagine that's not much more than that now.
Yeah, well, sorry, just to jump in, that was a stat that was in a article written about you, a great article by Damien Venuto, that I think we chatted before the podcast, saying that only 4% of the funding traditionally has been put towards things. And that is bananas, right?
Yeah, it is pretty bananas. But it's been probably historical. I think from my own experience, many times when I have pitched, I've pitched to predominantly an audience of men. Often there will be women in the room, and because the topic is quite sensitive anyway, you will have many women nodding when you describe the problem and the size of the market. But it's difficult, I think, when you cannot relate to what you are interested in investing in. At the same time, of course, you have to present a good business proposal. Investors are not just interested in the topic. They want a return on their money, and that's what the investing scene is all about. So I think along with getting yourself over the line, you do have to have a good business proposal, and you do have to have, you know, your strategies all in place that they can have confidence in your business. But it just means that your time spent trying to engage with your audience is much longer when it's predominated by an audience that perhaps can't relate or doesn't relate, you know, if it's a male-dominated audience. And as I say, for me personally, that has been my experience, is most of the people I've spoken to have been typically dominated. That's just what it is. But we have been fortunate. We've had great support, I'll just mention here, from our investors. So in particular, we are a spin-out of the University of Auckland. Our transfer office, Uni Services, have been very supportive. Our main investor, GD1, have been very supportive and have helped get us off the starting mark. You're always looking to raise money. We never have enough money. But, you know, we are a medical device, but we sit on between a consumer device and a medical device. So we wouldn't be considered picked up by hospitals, for instance, because you've got to have a lot of health economics data behind you before they will buy into a product like this. So we do sit on that cusp or that ridge between sort of direct to consumer and through healthcare professionals.
Tell us about that. Like, how would women be introduced to it? Would it be a medical practitioner advising them, or would they seek you out or find you online or through communities and then purchase it themselves?
What are
the avenues? Yeah,
it's both. As I mentioned, you know, I have quite a large network. We definitely are building our credibility amongst healthcare professionals, and many physiotherapists, particularly pelvic floor physiotherapists, know about us. We like to support them and their patients. We're very different from other medical devices that are on the market, or not medical devices, other devices that are on the market. The physiotherapists can use it in the clinic as well as the patients can use it at home. But if women want to, they can go directly to our website and buy it. You don't need to be referred. It's not something that you do have to see a healthcare professional for. So there's both pathways to purchases. You can either be referred through your healthcare professional. You can, if you want to, the healthcare professional can help keep an eye on your data. It's 12 weeks, you know, you've got to keep going. And so there's that capacity. If the patient agrees, the healthcare professional can actually look at the data as you're going through. But that's not absolutely necessary. We as a company also have algorithms that run over that data. We can put up red flags if we see something's going wrong. We try and help you with adherence.
Yeah. So it's like hardware, software, and a program of delivery. And
absolutely.
That can be self-directed.
Yep.
Or done in unison with a medical professional.
Yep.
Another one of these facts that, and this has been your whole career, so sorry to be like wandering into this as, you know, a total noob and just being very surprised. But, you know, finding out recently how many of the medical research tests had just been with white men and hadn't had any women in the drug testing groups and hadn't had, you know, ethnic background kind of spreads and stuff. It's kind of bananas, you know, to see that that's how the system has been. How have you found, researching and building a case around this for people to understand and into an environment like that?
Yeah, so traditionally, most of all our medical research has been done in men. So from heart disease to orthopedics, and as you mentioned, any drug testing usually has been done with men. It's been a hard road to get women involved with these sort of clinical trials. Working in the field of maternal health, it's somewhat easier because it is focused around women in terms of childbirth, at least. But incontinence affects women more than it affects men. But it's not exclusive, I might add, just there. But building a case for us, again, it's more tricky than if you had something that was really conventional, that would include both sexes. So it's, but you're right. Most medical research has always been as a result of clinical trials with men.
Wow. And like about your journey as the CEO of the company as well, like, how has that journey been for you from after building a career in midwifery and in research and, in the institute? How's it been to then go out and do all the things that it takes to raise money, build a team, get a device over the line, do the marketing, have plates spinning in 100 places at once?
Yeah, it's a totally huge learning curve. Mm-hmm. I think building a team has been enormously helpful, building a good team. I think as somebody very new to this, I didn't know a lot about anything. But I now know a little bit about everything. And I think what's important there is that then you can get in those expertise to know more about the areas that you only know a little bit about. So like marketing, I don't know anything about marketing, but I know a little bit. So to get people in there who are experts, you can know enough to know whether they're going to be doing a good job. I don't need to know about TikTok, but I need to know it exists and I need to know how to leverage off those kind of things. And the same goes, I guess, for things like, you know, finances and all that kind of thing. As the co-founder and CEO, I need to be the face of the company and also to do the fundraising mostly. And that was a very, and still is, a very steep learning curve. You naturally, I think, slip back into the areas that you're comfortable in. And my area is healthcare. My area is making a difference for women's health. But I am aware that in order to do that, we need a viable company. And so to do that, we need investment. So how do we do that? and that's the tricky bits. And those are the bits that have been big learnings for me.
And what is the big vision for the company? Like, what is that story for taking JunoFem and FemFit to the world?
So our mission is to be the most trusted solution for women's pelvic floor health globally. That is our mission. As I mentioned, we're having a big push into the UK now. We've got a lot of traction there in terms of the physiotherapists. Of course, it's a much bigger market, but they do have or they seem to have a lot more conversations around these issues than New Zealand or Australia at the moment. So there's a lot of publicity in incontinence. There's a lot of publicity around menopause. There's a lot more awareness in the general public that this is an issue. The concept of incontinence is openly spoken about in the more general publications. Menopause movements have been springing up everywhere. It's become quite commonplace in the workplace in many of these large organizations in the UK to be aware of menopause. I think it's coming here, but it's still not as open as it is in the UK. So, yeah, we're quite excited about that.
Yeah, and you know, just as an observer of the culture, I mean, there are some people doing some really great advocacy work here to bring more discussion about menopause and the experience into the consciousness. But working from a very low base, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I guess you have to start somewhere, and I'm delighted to see that the conversations are becoming much more prominent in, you know, in the general public space, both here in Australia, but we have a way to go, I think, to make it more open and out there.
What advice do you have for people who are looking to, you know, turn a great idea and a great product into a company?
I think if you've got a great idea and you want to build a product or you have a product, I think the first thing to do is really test your assumptions. Make sure that there actually is a market. Make sure that whatever it is you're building or whatever ideas you have and you're wanting to create a company, that somebody will pay for your services or your product. And all of us make assumptions. We all think whatever it is we're doing is great, is fantastic. But until you test that and really test it honestly, not just ask your mates and friends and family, you might end up building something and spending ages and years and many tears to find that actually nobody really wants what you've come up with. So I think that would be my one piece of advice, is really test your market and test how you're going to get into that market. How are you going to sell? Way before you start spending hours and bucket loads of money into actually creating something.
That's so interesting, hey, because even if it makes logical sense, it doesn't mean it works that way in the world, does it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
And as a final thought, what will success be for you, and what will success be for the company?
Well, for the company, I think success will be when we are, you know, the most respected company in terms of pelvic floor health for women, when people know who we are, they associate us with pelvic floor health. And for me personally is when I'm not needed anymore. When you can make me redundant, and that's success.
Ah, that's lovely. Well, thank you so much for coming and sharing the story so far, and can't wait to see where you take it next. That's Dr. Jenny Gruger of JunoFem. Kia ora.
Kia ora. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much to Jenny for joining us, to you for listening, and to everyone who helps make this happen, like our producer, Te Aihe Butler. Do follow and leave us a review if you like what we do. It really does help. And we'll see you soon. E no hora.
From the Spinoff Podcast Network, that was Business is Boring. Brought to you by SparkLab. Make sure you're following Business is Boring wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information on SparkLab, visit sparklab.co.nz. Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today. The Spinoff Podcast Network.